All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode, an action-packed, a high-caliber butt-kicking episode that we got prepared for you today. I'm really excited. You guys know me. I'm Bryce, joined as always by my co-host, Brendan Veman, reigning from the sunny state of Florida. Brendan, how are you doing, my man?
Doing fantastic, Bryce. Another great day in cryptocurrency, and this is a project that hits home to both of us. You know, yes. We've talked about them before. Hopefully, a lot of the listeners are familiar with this guest, as we are always excited to learn about the great world of not only DeFi, but when it comes to like RWAs and tokenization and all this great stuff. So, man,
yeah,
another great episode. Absolutely. Ready for the masses.
Absolutely. These guys are the it kids, I guess I'll say. The it kids in the RWA, real world asset tokenization realm. I'm going to stop beating around the bush. I'm just going to bring on our guest, the COO of Maple Finance, Ryan O'Shea. Welcome. How are you doing?
I'm good, gents. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, absolutely. And full disclosure, you know, I'm a holder of Maple, so always like to be disclosing that as we bring on awesome guests. I truly, you know, kind of put my money where my mouth is. I think Maple's awesome for many reasons, which I don't want to spoil it. I'm going to have you tell the good citizens of Crypt Nation all about Maple. But before we dive in, let's get acquainted, you and I, the audience. Ryan, kind of who are you? What were you doing before Maple? And really, what got you into crypto?
Yeah, absolutely. A good question to start with. I definitely had more of a traditional type background. I kind of call myself a recovering management consultant. So I spent 10 plus years in management consulting for my sins or whatever you want to call it. But spent the time in a lot of different competencies. So started off in kind of transaction services, working with a lot of large banks, doing, you know, M&A deals, loan portfolio deals. And what you'll start to see as I kind of talk through my experience is like a bit of a theme there of like efficiency, right? You know, started doing large deals with banks, you know, all that is just data aggregation, doing a lot of back office, middle office type work. So moved on from that then into like our data analytics practice. It's like, okay, you know, you've done this from the commercial side. How do you now start to build processes and systems that we can go and sell to banks? So did that for a number of years. And then again, you know, built these products and processes. So I was with EY at the time doing management consulting. They asked, hey, do you want to come to the US? Obviously, you can hear my Irish accent. It's very thick, so I'll slow down as we speak. Asked me to come over to the US.
Like
asked me to come over to the US to set up a similar business, but for more internal teams, so our large audit teams. So you can imagine these audit teams, you know, they do hundreds of thousands of hours just auditing files and data and scoping it, et cetera, et cetera. So it was around that time I also co-founded a business back in, you know, 2016, 2017. Like a lot of things came from, you know, a problem. I was going buying a house. I said, look, there has to be definitely a better and easier way to do this. And, you know, not to get into a long-winded version of it, but essentially what it was how do you take the residential buying process and digitize it? And it was upon that that I kind of stumbled into blockchain technology. Back then, they probably weren't called smart contracts, but, you know, that's what they are today. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of rolling through that, you know, conveyancing aspect, the legal aspect, you know, how does that get better? And as I mentioned, I'd since moved to the US. One of my buddies bought Bitcoin. And, you know, fast forward to today where I am at Maple, in between management consulting and Maple, spent a stint at Kraken where I led and built out our biz ops and strategy function. That's a very long-winded short version of my career of, you know, traditional management consulting, you know, working in, I wasn't in a bank or working in back office, middle office, but I was definitely working alongside those functions. And then, you know, fast forward to today, definitely where I am in Maple and how I fell in love with, you know, crypto and went down the rabbit hole like a lot of us did.
Yeah. You said you got this awesome, you know, kind of traditional background. And when you were buying that house, you saw a big problem. Was that kind of the moment that you realized, oh, blockchain is going to be a big part of the future? It has the potential to kind of re-architect, you know, the back ends of finance, but also every industry. Was that kind of that aha moment?
I don't think it was the aha moment. I think it was like it just planted a seed, right? So it was back in 2016. I was like, oh, that's interesting. Didn't think anything of it. A year or two later, bought Bitcoin, started doing more research on it, and then more and more. And then I think it was until, you know, 2019, 2020 when I joined Kraken that I was spending much more of my personal time and then wanted to spend my professional time in it. I said, hey, look, like, this is the future. I've seen where my past was. I've seen the benefits of it. I think that's when the aha moment was. I think it was more at the early stages. I probably didn't know what it was, but I knew there was something in there and it was percolating in my brain, and it probably took a couple of years for it to come to fruition.
100%. Yeah, I love Kraken for what it's worth. Awesome exchange. So walk us through from a high level before we kind of get into the nitty gritty all about Maple. You know, we kind of want to know, why does it exist? What problem is it solving? And we'll start there and we'll dovetail into different parts of the ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely. So Maple is a digital asset lending business. So we've been around for, you know, a number of years now, 3 or 4 years. And what we're probably previously known for was more of a permissionless DeFi protocol doing unsecured lending to market makers. You know, I would say in the last 18 months, there's been a definite shift in what we are today. And what we are today is more of a buttoned up permission institutional digital asset lending business. So we have two main products. One is our blue chip product, which is where we offer institutional borrowers over-collateralized loans against Ethereum and Bitcoin and derivatives of that, a blue chip, you know, by the name, by the assets. And then the other large product that we have is high yield secured. So exact same product as the blue chip, but in that sense, we take on different collateral types. So we'll take, you know, top 10 alts. And then on top of that, we will start to do more things with that collateral. So in the case of if we take in Solana, we may stake that with an institutional provider or a portion that may be on lent. So there are two kind of main buckets. So I'd say we've definitely moved away from doing unsecured lending. Everything on Maple at the moment is either secured by something or fully over-collateralized. The secured by something, we can get into it a little bit, is our cash management solution, where we have tokenized short-dated T-bills and put them on chain. But I would say, you know, that's probably less than 5% of our business. What we're really known for and what we're growing out and what has grown in the last 6 months is our over-collateralized lending business.
Awesome. And then kind of walk us through, you know, I think it's really popular, you know, CeFi lending models. The DeFi lending models are still being, you know, being innovated on. What is like the main big difference, you know, 101 level difference between CeFi or centralized financial lending and then decentralized financial lending?
Yeah, good question. And it's probably, you know, not black or white. It's probably a spectrum, right? There's for probably, sure. You know, you probably have CeFi on one end, which was what we would call like OTC, over-the-counter lending, where essentially you're sending your collateral or your tokens into a wallet, and then you don't get to see what happens with it, whether it gets rehypothecated, whether it gets staked, whether it gets on-lent, et cetera, et cetera. Then you have, on the other end of the spectrum, fully DeFi. You're sending it into a smart contract. All loans are on chain, all collateral is stored on chain, examples of that, Aave, Compound, etc. What we have seen probably change since, and this is a big learning from, I guess, the last cycle, is people are no longer willing to lend into a black box. They're no longer willing just to send their tokens, their assets, into an OTC provider and then don't see what is happening on the other end. Who is the counterparty that is getting lent? What is the concentration levels? Et cetera, et cetera. So you're seeing, you know, we don't have to name the names, but a lot of those players obviously aren't around today. And that's where we see kind of Maple fitting in to fill that void of all the CeFi players that left behind. You know, last cycle, there was probably north of 50 billion of assets that were lent out. What Maple is, it's not quite on the spectrum of fully on-chain with Aave and Compound in terms of our collateral is actually sitting with qualified custodians. And that is a feature, not a bug. So a lot of our institutional borrowers actually won't put their collateral into smart contracts. Because the biggest thing for them, if they're a long-only fund or a directional fund, is actually liquidation risk. They do not want that collateral to be liquidated. And again, they obviously want, you know, that kind of white glove service. They want someone on the other end of the phone. So that's where kind of Maple sits, is where all of our lending in terms of how we aggregate the capital is done on chain with our lenders, but our collateral that is sitting with qualified custody with, you know, Anchorage, BitGo, Zodia, and a few others, that is not sitting on chain, but it is an API called into our web app. So we are still showing that transparency and keeping near and dear, you know, the benefits that is on chain lending.
Yeah. And you said that, you know, some of your lenders are essentially adding their collateral to smart contracts or making sure that they're tied to smart contracts, which I think is a crucial part of this technology, right? And it also makes me curious, like, what role do you think that RWAs and tokenization, two buzzwords, right, that we've been hearing a lot more of in the last year, but like, what role do you think that RWAs and tokenization can play in something like this? And I guess before we even explain like the role that they have to play, for the listeners who are out there and going, what in the world is an RWA and what does tokenization mean? I guess let's explain what those concepts are, and then explain like the role that they have in what we see as maybe the next generation of lending and borrowing and DeFi.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been probably pretty vocal about this in the past. I'm not the biggest fan of the name RWA, but you know, for all intents and purposes, RWA is real world assets. So it's essentially traditional assets, but tokenizing them and putting them on chain. And what I mean by that is a representation of that on chain. So if I use, you know, the example that I was talking about earlier for our cash management product, that is short dated treasury bills. So treasury bills that are sitting with a custodian in, you know, it could be a JP Morgan or others. And taking that treasury bill, tokenizing it and putting on chain. So it's a representation of it. So it's a token that sits on chain. You can hold on to that, and dependent on, you know, the regulation and rules of where that LP is sitting, you can trade it with a whitelisted address. You can post it as collateral, et cetera, et cetera. But I would say, given the T-bill example that I gave, it is quite hard to actually be quite composable with that asset. But in terms of where do we see this going, like I think as more and more assets come on chain, the benefits of blockchain technology come to light. So if you look at, you know, the first real world use case was stablecoins. So all of, if not the majority of lending on Maple today is done in stablecoins and USDC. That was the first example of a US dollar tokenized and put on chain. So like the benefits of that, you know, are like vastly improve of what a US dollar can do in today's terms, in terms of, you know, it trades 24/7. You can use it 24/7, 7 days a week. So you're automatically getting more hours in the day that you can actually do things with it. You can post it as collateral in different places. It has instant settlement. So you're not waiting on, you know, if you look at my background where there was a lot of back office and middle office work of IOUs and paperwork, et cetera, that is all removed away. So I think in these early days or these early innings of RWAs and tokenization, we've seen obviously stablecoins have been around for a number of years now. You've seen over the last 24 months, you start to see short-dated treasury bills kind of taking off. As more and more assets come on chain, the kind of liquidity or the price risk of people holding their assets on chains and the duration that they want to put those assets on chains expands. So today, people are quite conscious of how long they want to put their assets on chain, how long they want to look at yield for. So you're starting to see, you know, I would say at the moment for Maple, we're seeing if someone wants to get yield for 3 months, 6 months, that's probably the top end of where they're putting their assets on chain. But as I mentioned, you're seeing asset managers and other assets coming on chain. If people are holding their balance sheet on chain, then you'll start to think things like tokenizing property, tokenizing other long durated assets. So I think we have a bit to go yet in terms of people wanting duration, like as in for yield on their assets. But I think we're definitely getting there, and there's definitely more and more announcements coming, and we're excited about it. For Maple, you know, other than that cash management solution, I would say our focus and priority over these next 18 months is definitely going to be on digital assets. But as we kind of enter that next bear cycle and rates on chain kind of get compressed, that's when we start looking at some of these more other RWA type assets and how we can start to bring them on chain and be kind of more of a providing a portfolio of yield opportunities.
You know, definitely. When I guess let's backtrack to a second ago, when you started that, you said you weren't too fond of the term RWAs. Is that because you prefer the term tokenization? Or I guess give us the backstory behind that, because a lot of people do like hear that phrase a lot. Again, it's fairly new. It's coming to the spotlight. Just walk us through your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I just kind of think of them as traditional assets. Like I think when you think of real world assets, what is the opposite of it? Are digital assets not real? You know, I just kind of take that standpoint of it gives me a nick, or, you know, rubs me the wrong way. Just call them traditional assets, and then you know we have digital assets, because then you're always going to be comparing one versus the other.
Yeah, it's funny. Also, one of our mutual friends from Superstate, he mentioned he was like, I hate this name, RWAs. He goes, I'm from the banking world. RWA is risk-weighted asset. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, it's like a completely different meaning in the traditional world. And so he's like, yeah, it's kind of like a stopgap of a phrase before we really figure out what the next sort of phrase is going to be.
I agree.
So, you know, I'm curious, you know, when BlackRock kind of came into the market and they announced their BIDL fund, BlackRock US dollar institutional digital liquidity or something like that. They're kind of playing in the same space as you with the tokenization and the lending and the yield. Do you view them or are they like direct, is that BIDL fund directly competing with Maple, or is it more of like, hey, this is a partnership opportunity, and kind of where would those connection points be?
I definitely wouldn't see them as competing. I would welcome more asset managers to come into the space. As I kind of mentioned earlier, the more assets that can come on chain, the better for all of us, the more use cases it is. Particularly in that case with the BIDL fund, it would be a slight competitor to our cash management solution. But look, I think there's, you named Jim, you know, and Superstate and all the others that are out there. I think it's how can we all grow the pie together versus, you know, sharp elbows and sticking them out to a certain degree. I think, you know, Coinbase have also come out. They're looking at putting a portion of their balance sheet on chain. You know, the more and more we can get these assets on chain, the less peaks and troughs we'll have during these cycles. And the more people will remain on chain during the bear and bull cycles. That'll be better for all of us.
Absolutely. I hope people stick around this time. I've been through a couple bull markets and bear markets, and I've seen some fair weather friends. I told you before we started recording, I was out with an old coworker. And you know, we were working in crypto years and years ago, and then, you know, he left and he went for some other company and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, 4 years later, crypto's back mooning. He's like, I'm back. I'm working for a crypto company now. And so it's like, you know, there are some fair weather fans. I'm curious if he's listening to this, shoot me a text if you heard that. But no, you guys are, you know, doing some serious numbers. I think I saw the most recent, amount of loans y'all originated was around $4.11 billion in loans originated to over 85 institutional borrowers. So, you know, there's probably a lot of learnings. I know you mentioned, you know, about 18 months ago when FTX collapsed, you know, you guys kind of redid the business model and rethought some things. What are some other learnings or things that you know, big takeaways during that process, you know, in the past 18 months? That you kind of gotten from, you know, $4 billion of loans originated. You definitely, you know, hit the nail on the head. You guys found a product market fit for sure.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's probably building on my earlier point about transparency and trust, you know, on both sides of the fence. So on the sides of the fence with our institutional borrowers, as I previously mentioned, you know, they want to know where the collateral is sitting. What trust level do they place on Maple, us as a business, and us as the processes and InfoSec and procedures that we have in place. And then also the lenders. And this is a bigger, I would say, transparency and visibility and trust type of scenario. So not a big kind of thing that I would put out there is not all yield is equal, right? All of the loans on Maple are backed by the largest institutions in the space. All of the loans are significantly over collateralized, so, you know, 150% plus. But not only that, is you can see everything either on chain or via API through our APIs with our custodians. So I think that the biggest thing for us was, you know, you're not going to have, you know, large presence or large product market fit from a lending standpoint if you aren't showing what you're doing with that collateral, where it is sitting, what are the underlying loans that you're putting out there, and, you know, just in general how you communicate what is happening, etc., etc. So the biggest learning for us is, and this is the truth to the core of Maple, is transparency and openness, and whether that's, you know, built via our smart contract infrastructure or whether that's how we represent ourselves externally and how we transparently communicate, both on the borrower and lending side. So I think that's like the biggest learning and takeaway that we've taken, and how we've pivoted the product and how we'll continue to push that into how we want to do this for the industry, and, you know, as much as possible, give the information that we have available to us to all of our stakeholders and partners as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And one of the really big new releases that I know that I've been watching out for here is the launch of Syrup. So I'd love to just get your thoughts on this, because this is it's a big deal, right? For the Maple ecosystem. So I'd love to have you just walk us through, you know, everything that is encompassed when it comes to syrup.
Yeah, absolutely. And so kind of, if I go back to what Maple is our institutional business, fully permissioned, fully KYC'd, there's qualifications in place, you have to be accredited investor and up, you know, there's minimum check sizes applied. So minimum check size is 100K to deposit into Maple. So that's what Maple is. And Maple will continue to be that. And now what Syrup is, and we launched Syrup to early access 2 weeks ago, and then yesterday to full access. It's already at, I think last I checked, is about 30 million TVL. So it's been a strong growth in terms of just having early access. But what Syrup is that exact same product that we have for Maple in terms of secured lending to institutional borrowers, but it is a separate loan book, separate entity, and it is only for offshore. So it'll be ex-US, ex-UK, and actually ex-Australian as well. But the biggest thing that unlocks is it allows us to tap into the permissionless lenders. So there will be no KYC. There will be wallet and sanction scans for depositing, but there isn't any minimums. So you can literally deposit $1 into Syrup, whereas, you know, on the Maple side, you know, minimum check size is 100K. So that's one key differentiator. The other biggest unlock that has for us, obviously on the Maple side, those LP tokens, unless you're interacting with another whitelisted address, you can't really do anything with them. So they're not very composable. You know, you can't use them in DeFi. But with the Syrup LP tokens, given the permissionless nature of it, there's many different avenues that we can look to work with those with that LP token. So we are in talks with different partners on the DeFi side. We're also looking at setting up an AMM, so a secondary market, given that these are, you know, they are open term loans, but they're a fixed period on liquidity in terms of how we lend them out to borrowers. There is a certain liquidity profile. So as the book gets bigger and bigger, we want to have an AMM secondary market that people can trade in and out of their positions. They can take those LP tokens, post them as collateral, and do a bunch of other cool and interesting things that allows, you know, we're actually using the benefits of blockchain and making it more composable overall. So that's Maple in short. We're really excited about it. Opened up to early access just yesterday. So, or not early access, to full access yesterday. So we're excited to see the continued growth of it.
Yeah, Syrup is going to be a huge, huge thing. I think particularly right now, is there's a lot of, you know, hype and stuff around the launch. But I also think as the regulatory winds start to change, you're going to be able to access, hopefully, within the next year or 2 years, if we get a new administration, or if we get some kind of, you know, Senate bill, or basically bills passed, new laws and stuff that give you know, a little bit more regulatory clarity, so that you could, you know, offer this to Americans and folks in the UK and Australia. But I guess it's a little ways away, and I think a lot of people at home, like even you know, friends, family, they ask, like, why are so many crypto projects like not offering stuff to Americans? Like, I don't get it. And it's hard for me to explain sometimes too, but like, what's the actual reason? Is it like the yield component is a security, or, you know, why is it so, you know, hard to launch things in America when there's yield? And when is that going to change ever?
I would hope it does change. So I would be the same cap as you. But I think the short and easy answer is there isn't proper guidance, right? So it's like, what is the safest and easiest path to, you know, to safe harbor? And that's the path that we've chosen. We obviously lean on, you know, larger players in the space who are willing to have those battles with the SEC and, you know, have large legal and regulatory teams. But it's just that we don't know. It's like the powerful thing, right? It's we definitely understand what we've done on the Maple side and the setup that we have there and the regulatory posture that allows us to do what we do. But just in a permissionless environment, given all of the, you know, lawsuits and everything that has happened over the last 18 to 24 months, is not something that we have an appetite to go looking for.
Yeah, definitely.
And then I'd say kind of rolled in with the regulatory environment is also Some of our institutional clients on the Maple side will remain on that side, right? There's a reason why we put that permissioned items in place in terms of knowing the KYC of the customers, having accreditation in place. So there is institutional borrowers who will not move across on the Maple side. And we'll see that kind of trend continue as we get to more and more traditional type capital. And as they start coming on chain, that'll be a product that like Maple will be supporting versus something that Syrup would be doing in the future. So there will be that distinctification, not only on the lender side, but also on the borrower side as well.
Yeah, no, I love this. I mean, it expands your services. It makes it more, I guess, manageable for people all around the world in all different scenarios. And that's really a big part of all of this, right? And I guess kind of along those same lines, like, what do you think is one of the biggest roadblocks for when it comes to things like tokenization and decentralized lending at the moment? You know, do you think it's something that's like regulatory, or is it user experience, or is it something else beyond those?
Yeah, I think like I'd agree with those two. I think they're definitely issues, but I think the biggest crux of the problem that we see is just liquidity and assets that are sitting on chain. So if you look at one end of the spectrum, especially on the RWA, you have pent-up demand on the borrower side. So even like in the digital asset space, we'd have pent-up demand. And what you see in the RWA space, you know, people are willing to tokenize anything, right? Like the people are willing to borrow anything. But that doesn't mean that there's always assets sitting on their side to lend to them. So we are across the industry just short on dollars. And, you know, we talked earlier about BlackRock, and we talked about other asset managers and Coinbase and a few others. It's like the quicker and faster that more of these assets, whether they're just sitting on, you know, balance sheets and treasury management, whether they're sitting in Biddle funds, whether they're sitting, you know, in Superstate or others, the better it is for all of us, because then we don't have to deal with the secondary issue that I'm going to talk about, is like the on-off ramping. And that kind of ties into the UI. But that is still a big, big problem today. Because where we look at, you know, Maple and how we would position ourselves, we would position ourselves against, you know, typical private credit funds, and how do we go after and compete with them? Whereas if we can solve some of those UI and on off ramping elements, then it becomes purely who has the better yield profile, what is the product they're offering versus, oh, you know, that's on crypto, there's a risk premium, I have to have that, I have to have the setup for it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And I think, you know, like you said, you know, we got to get more assets on chain. And I think when you have like the Fidelities, the BlackRocks of the world, Franklin Templeton, I saw they're doing some tokenization stuff. As all this, you know, these real world, not real world, but I'm not going to say RWAs, all these, you know, traditional sort of firms and stuff bringing their assets on chain, that will start to unlock the liquidity. It will start to unlock, you know, all this, you know, great utility. I guess my question is, from your viewpoint, how long is it going to take for these centralized lenders or asset managers to kind of really get fully on board with DeFi?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's always one of those questions, how long is a piece of string? But I definitely think it's probably not as long as 10 years, but it's definitely longer than 5 years. Like to see a real movement, because like a couple of things need to happen, and we've mentioned a few of them already, but like one is just a simple setup of getting those assets on chain. Then there's the comfort level, there's the setup, the UI, the governance. You think of some of these larger organizations, there's a steep learning curve for them on that side. So I think, you know, I definitely don't think it's probably within 5 years, but it's probably between 5 to 10 years is when we'll see a complete shift and change. And I don't think it's we're waiting for 5 years. I definitely think it's, you know, happening week on week, month on month, year after year. But we're still a ways away from everything being there tomorrow. And that's why I think there's a bit of a journey that we need to go on. And that's what I was kind of hinting at earlier about the duration and assets sitting on chain and how long people are willing to stick around for. And that's all kind of predicated on how long people are sitting on chain and how long their assets are going to be sitting there for, and if it's sitting there for a longer period versus a shorter period.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point, because when it comes to the crypto space, we're used to things moving fast, being volatile, right? And so when we even talk about these new and emerging industries, people want instant gratification. And even in crypto, that's not always the case. You know, we look at so-called RWAs and tokenization and all this stuff, and all of us here truly do believe that it's going to play a massive part in the future, but maybe that's not this year. You know, maybe that's not this cycle. Maybe that is in a cycle or two or three cycles away. But we're talking about this stuff before it's mainstream, right? You know, we're talking about this stuff before every big TradFi player and every kind of big lender and before it's the standard and all this. But I like the point that you made that, you know, hey, maybe this is somewhere between 5 to 10 years out. And I think that's a lesson that a lot of people in crypto need to understand is that they go, you know, why haven't we mooned yet? And why hasn't this happened? And why don't I have my 100x bags and all this stuff, right? Well, and that's because like even on the fundamental side, the structural side of making this technology become mainstream, that might be 5 to 10 years out. And everything's not always this instant gratification overnight. So I love that. I think it's a point. And it's not to say that this stuff isn't working and it's not growing and it's not getting adopted. It's not the case at all. It is at rapid rate, but it takes time. I mean, we're talking about the financial structure of like what could be the next generation. And yeah. So that's not something that's going to happen overnight, but man, the moves are certainly happening here and the infrastructure is getting laid.
And I would also add, like, I don't think it's lost on, or it shouldn't be lost on anyone, that progress is being made behind closed doors. Like, there is work being done on private blockchains. There is work, you know, assets being put on chain in other public blockchains. So it's just a matter of time. And you know, we're going to be definitely here waiting for them. But as much as we can help and support, it'll be the better for everyone.
Absolutely. I'm also curious, the MPL token, for the Maple ecosystem, tell us, you know, what role this plays in the ecosystem and, kind of how you guys are envisioning the future of MPL.
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. And actually, as we announced Syrup, we also announced a migration of the MPL token. So the MPL token as it is today is a governance token. It doesn't have any other use cases as it stands. But there will be a migration in start of Q4 or Q4 at some point where we'll move all MPL to Syrup. It'll be a one-to-one migration for all users. So there won't be any split or anything like that. And what that'll allow us to do and unlock is previously we had, you know, a community and we had the Maple product, but we had users and community users and owners of MPL who actually couldn't use the product, right? For all the reasons that I mentioned, you know, minimum check size, permissioned, et cetera, et cetera. But what this will do is it'll bring our community and our users back together with Syrup. And then it'll allow us obviously to rebrand the name of the Tokel MPL to Syrup. And as part of the Syrup launch, we didn't touch on this, but we're actually also running a points program, which is called Drips. You know, we're definitely playing on the Maple Syrup pancake, you know, on the analogies here for sure. So the Drips program is being run at the moment, and that is just incentivizing outcomes that we would like to see on the platform. You know, big thing for us is duration. So if you can lock up your capital for 3 months, 6 months, and there is incentives on Drips. And then the other thing that we kind of touched on a bit earlier is how do we start to build out an AMM and secondary market? So we do have incentives for Drips if people will commit their capital to an AMM. So that will be happening later this year. We're targeting Q4. So we are in the back end, you know, working with exchanges, et cetera, to get that migration to happen. There'll be more details once they're made available to the community, probably end of Q3 timeframe.
That sounds awesome.
And then something else.
I was going to say, you mentioned the name, and that was one of my other questions. I was like, you know, I'm curious where the name Maple and Syrup and Drip, and like, I know on your website, the icon's a pancake. And so what's the thought process there?
Yeah, so that's actually a back in the day from finance, if either of you from those backgrounds, how you understand the debt stack. So you have your different tranches of debt. So you can imagine the pancakes, you can envision the syrup dripping over the pancakes. So the syrup essentially is just dripping down the different tranches of debt. And, you know, when we're all in school or in undergraduate, and we were learning about the debt stack, it was just, it kind of had two meanings, right? It was like a symbol that Sid and Joe kind of came up with, and then Maple was an easy name to remember, one syllable, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the story and history behind Maple, or the pancakes, I guess.
That's super funny and super cool and appropriate. And I'm curious, like, so if a user wants to go, they want to check out Maple, check out Syrup, what kind of rates can they kind of expect across the different product offerings?
Yeah, absolutely. So the cash management solution that I mentioned is just tokenized T-bills. So that's sitting around, you know, 5% or depending on where the short dated T-bill rate is at. The blue chip that I mentioned, which is the Bitcoin and Ethereum backed loans, is sitting around, I'd say, 10 to 11% net to lenders. The high yield currently is just shy of 19% via Maple. And then on the Syrup side, just for simplicity's sake, it's just one pool that is live at the moment. And that is kind of a blend of our high yield and blue chip offering done in a different entity, different loan book, but that type of an offering. And that is netting about 16, 17% at the moment.
Great.
And then the one thing I would probably add to that, and like the differentiation between us and, you know, other DeFi protocols, is obviously the yield is derived from us giving out loans to institutional borrowers. So that rate doesn't whipsaw around. It's right. It's quite consistent. It's quite expected. So both on the lending side, our lenders appreciate that they can have consistent yield. And then on the borrower side, obviously, you know, they can also appreciate the consistent payments, et cetera, and visibility that they have for treasury management on their end.
I actually have one follow-up question on that, because I'm curious how, like, if the rates start getting cut later in the year and they start to come back down, how does that like affect your business and affect the rates that people can expect?
Yeah, so the rates will always be driven what the funds rate is, right? So what loans that we can have out at a given time. It obviously, you know, moves down in times of when rates compress in the industry, those rates will obviously come down. And that's what I was kind of starting to talk about a bit earlier, is Maple always wants to be the home of digital asset lending. So it's like, now during the bull cycle, what we're concentrating on digital asset lending, given that rates are where they are and they're quite interesting. But as they start to compress and we enter, you know, another bear cycle, there is a kind of like, I would say, call it like a risk premium for people putting their assets on chain and like interacting with crypto. And where we've kind of seen that is kind of, you know, 10% on SOFR. So at the moment, it's, you know, kind of around 15%. So what we would see as, you know, rates start to compress and, you know, we start potentially entering another bear cycle, that's when we would start to look at other lending, other real world assets. You know, I use the term, but traditional assets, and how we could bring them on and have uncorrelated risk to crypto. Because if you think of what happened 15 months ago when the plethora of T-bill, treasury bill offerings came on, it was because rates were, you know, 1-2%, in some cases negative. So that's why a 5% on-chain yield was interesting. And that's why, you know, there's many and many providers out there. Whereas we see, you know, we definitely don't think we're anywhere near, I don't even think we've, you know, some people question whether we're starting a bull cycle in the middle of it or whatnot. But that is something that we definitely keep an eye on. And as rates come down, that's when we start to bring in other offerings that are uncorrelated from how we generate that yield to crypto prices. So that's like one thing in the short term, and then longer term, as we've discussed over and over and over again. But as those assets and those bigger players come on chain, hopefully those peaks and troughs starting to smooth out a little bit. And, you know, we don't have such wide bull and bear market cycles.
You know, kind of along those same lines, do you ever think that there's going to be different rates for different products, especially when we tokenize, you know, assets for different purposes? You know, say someone's going to get, even like in the traditional world, if someone's going to get a loan on a house that they're planning on living in, the rates are going to be lower than for a house that is going to be for a rental property. Or if someone's going to get just a straight cash loan, they're going to come at a different rate than both of those other two. So do you ever see there being a world, like specifically in the DeFi lending space, where people could be having different rates on Maple for different lending purposes, if that makes sense?
Are you talking about the on the borrower side, Brendan?
Yes.
Yeah, so that happens today. So not only do we underwrite the collateral, we underwrite the borrower. So we actually have recourse to the borrower. Wow. So we look at their financials. So every deal that we do is bespoke to that borrower. So that's like it's not like one size fits all. And we say, here's your collateral and here's your collateral ratio. Your LTV ratio. Every borrower actually goes through a full credit underwriting and full due diligence. So that already happens today and will continue to happen.
Yeah, I'm curious on like on-chain credit scoring. Is that a thing? Is anybody working on that?
There has been some progress in the past. You know, I know S&P and a few others are working on it. And there's a couple of new startups, I think Particular or or I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, a couple others doing it. But I think it's not widespread. So I definitely think it's something, you know, we leaned and we have the discussions time and time again. But I just think it's not something that has taken off or something that is representative of, you know, the size of the loans that have already been originated on chain. But I definitely think it'll be something that will be in place in the next couple of years. And it'll be something that people will look to, because what we want to move away from is abstracting away all the diligence and risk and items that we talked about earlier, and the transparency that every single lender is expected to run through, and that they have something that they can rely upon, a name behind it that they can rely upon. And it makes their due diligence cycles a bit shorter.
Well, outside the world of DeFi lending, do you have a favorite use case for blockchain technology?
I would say, I'm not sure is it outside DeFi, but I think like it's payments, right? It's just instant settlement, the ability to transact on a peer-to-peer basis, or whether that's a peer-to-peer or enterprise to enterprise. I think that has to be the killer app and the most used use case that should be more widespread. You know, there's a plethora of fintechs that have emerged over the last 15, 10 years trying to do similar things, but are doing it in a much more archaic and inefficient processes. I think that payments should be something that's front and center and something that we all should be doing, whether that's, you know, how we receive our payroll, how we pay our vendors, all of that, I think, should be transitioned and be done on chain, and it should be more acceptable how we do our day-to-day lives and retail and everything else.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Ryan, in closing, I'm curious where people can find out more, where people can get involved. Where do you send people?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say definitely check out maple.finance. And then as of yesterday, I would say check out syrup.fi. And then I'm not sure if people will be interested in following me, but definitely you can check me out on X at ryanos_eth.
Awesome. Ryan, thank you so much. And then when you're back in town, we'll grab a drink. Hopefully you have safe travels, and talk to you soon. Thanks for joining.
Absolutely. Cheers, gents. We'll talk to you soon.
Cheers.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Terms and conditions apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Save big this holiday season, all in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.